politics without the soap opera, with unfiltered constitutional conservative truth. The Conservative Review with Daniel Horowitz.
And welcome back, fellow American patriots and Minutemen standing at the ready to fight anew for every issue that matters in the way it matters, at the time it matters, and it is certainly an arduous task to focus on every issue, but we try to cover as many as possible here at Sierra Podcast. It is Friday the 29th, Good Friday for our Christian audience. And, you know, I think on a day like today, we're going to borrow from an old Protestant doctrine used back during the times of the Reformation, but it applies to all systems of governance, particularly ours today, the doctrine of lesser magistrate. And really the only escape valve we have to fighting federal tyranny are the red areas in this country where the overwhelming majority or strong majority of people agree that things are crazy, working together with their local and state governments that have a significant amount of power, you know, more so than where the doctrine came from, given the design of our federalist system, to thwart almost every bad thing that we don't like. Yet it is so bizarre, it's surreal how we live in a world where there is a significant amount, almost half the country, that doesn't just disagree with what's going on, but recognizes, oh my gosh, this is crazy, but yet they are so uninformed about who is participating in this and how to get out of it. They're unaware that there's red states. They're unaware that their supermajority is being squandered. They're unaware of these down-the-ballot primaries. They slept through the presidential primary. So I want to delve into, you know, through the prism of some of the big issues of immigration, crime, maybe green energy if we have time, that all the things that we're leaving on the table and how, as we head towards the end of these legislative sessions, you could gauge our success or failure commensurate with how much effort we actually put in, how much of a movement we have grown on the ground in various states to raise awareness that A, Republicans are part of the problem, and B, we have another path to dealing with the uniparty, pretty much only in the states where we have a Freedom Caucus, and you'll see it doesn't have to be this way. You get commensurate with what you fight for. But first, I do want to start off at a federal level with one federal item to just once again demonstrate that making red states red and focusing people's attention on that is really our only path. I just first want to preface with a little anecdote that I had earlier this morning, and it really is emblematic of the frustration I know a lot of you have in this audience that exists among the majority of Republican voters. At the end of morning prayers, we had, you know, Bible study, I come out, and a guy that I never really speak to comes up to me, and you know, people do this from time to time, wanting to start a political conversation. They know what I do, even if I don't really know who they are. And they say, man, the liberals are just getting insane, crazier by the day. And I look at him and I say, yeah, and you know, really, both parties are part of this. He kind of gives me a blank look, and then I start to explain. I said, you know that there's a lot we can be doing about this, maybe not here in Maryland, but the significant swaths of the country where Republicans have 4-1 majorities. Did you know that? And, you know, they're part of the problem. And we, you know, I started kind of going through the 3-minute elevator pitch of my typical message of all the things we're doing. And, you know, you could tell the light bulb is starting to turn on there. Like, yeah, I guess. Oh, wow. It's interesting. And I say, you know, like, this is true in every state except for Florida. You know, you remember the guy who ran for president? Yeah, you know. And I have this conversation really over and over again. And I know a lot of you probably find this among your family, friends, relatives. I mean, I don't associate with liberals. You know, just the way it is, I don't really have liberals. I mean, you know, among those who are biblical Jews, such as myself, I mean, most religious Jews are not liberal, obviously. But like anyone else, I mean, very few people really know what is going on in a specific way. They know Biden's crazy, the Democrats are off the wall, and that's about it. And then there's just kind of something called Trump. Take it or leave it, that's what we have. And boy, you know, Trump better win November, and then I'll go back to sleep after that. How do we change that? I don't know. I don't know how we change that, but change it we must. That is really the key. It's funny, I talk about Deuteronomy 30 a lot, how, you know, these words are not distance from you. They're not over the sea that you have to say, you know, let me get a boat and go overseas to grab it, or in the heavens that we have to build a ladder, a gateway to heaven to bring it down. But the laws and the statutes and the Torah, doing what's right, is right here in your mouth and your heart to do it. And I've said this all along, while we might only have 45% of the country, you know, of the voters, but we have 100% of, I mean, if you add up the territory of red counties and states, it's a lot more than half, but I'll take half. We have 100% of that half, because if we actually awakened our people and just informed them of what's going on and focused their attention on the right things, you would 100% control that half. And I would guarantee you, if you 100% controlled that half, you would staunch a lot of these federal policies just by virtue of the contrast. No one wants misery. No one wants to live in misery. And if you really had a bold contrast, it would be very hard. I mean, I said this all along, if we had all the red states were bold from day one on COVID, that in itself would have not just created an escape in half of America, which we didn't have ultimately, but it would have been a check and a balance. And I want to, you know, get to that with immigration. It's so easy if they just stood up. But we don't have it because Republicans suck. Republicans suck because we fall asleep in the primaries. We fall asleep in the primaries. We sleep through them. Because we don't have a movement focusing people on the problem. The people with possession of the ball in red states are the ones we need to be blitzing. But we don't blitz them. We blitz the people on the side that don't really have any power. If we just more efficiently and effectively focused our attention, again, on the issues that matter, in the way they matter, the time they matter, the strategies, the legislation, the processes, the primaries that matter, we would have a different country. Because again, yeah, I mean, most of what the left is doing is extremely unpopular. So if you had a movement in place in red states that effectively crossed swords with these policies, that utilized catalyzing events and current events and certain legislative tools and you know, governing tools to accentuate the issue while also opposing it, things would change. Remember, I say this all the time. The more you do, the more you do, the more you achieve. The public views it, wow, that's the right thing to do. See, if all you do is talk, but then the left does, it looks like the left is, they're the ones governing, and you're the ones just like spewing conspiracy theories. But if you actually make this the reality, no, this is what we're doing, seeing is believing, people are like, wow, that's really going on. And one of the things I want to talk about is, again, to demand special sessions on the border. You'll never get a more winning issue. We'll go through some of the news on that and what needs to be done. But getting back to federal, you know, I started off last year saying how the only thing that mattered was the budget bill, and as an adjacent, an ancillary, some of the must-pass, you know, NDAAs, reauthorization bills like FISA. And the Democrats started talking about even more funding for Ukraine. And I warned you guys at the time. I said, this is a rope-a-dope and this is an Overton window shifter. What they're doing is they're saying, oh, we might pass a new bad bill. And I said, well, wait a minute. You get that for free. Once you control the House after the 2022 elections, it should be a given that the Republican-controlled House is not going to pass new aid for Ukraine. The question is how much we're going to roll back by holding up their must-pass bills like budget bills. And I expressed concern at the time. I said, Johnson's going to declare victory by blocking the Ukraine bill, which we get for free, all the while, you know, ignoring the fact that he betrayed us on the budget bills. But alas, I was wrong. It's worse than that. He's not even fighting that. He is downright working overtime to pass Ukraine funding. That is now his biggest priority. And there's been a sudden change. This is from Punchbowl News. Speaker Mike Johnson and his leadership team know they may need to get creative in order to have any hope of getting Ukraine aid package to President Biden's desk. Think about that. This is what their effort is focused on. You might think, oh my gosh, we got to think of innovative ways to stop Biden. Biden's threatening to give green cards to illegals now. We have to find ways to stop it. No. His entire subterfuge, plotting, and scheming is how to end run around conservatives to get Biden a Ukrainian aid bill, with House Republicans largely opposed to new aid for Kyiv, especially if new border security provisions don't ride alongside it. GOP leaders have been searching for ways to sell an aid package to Ukraine skeptics. A centerpiece of that effort is likely to be the Rebuilding Economic Prosperity and Opportunity for Ukrainian Act. REPO. The legislation cleared the Senate Foreign Relations Committee nearly unanimously in January. It's a key part of Rhino Representative Brian Fitzpatrick's bipartisan slim down foreign aid border security package. It gives Biden the authority to confiscate frozen Russian assets and use them to pay for Ukraine reconstruction efforts. So basically what they want to say is, okay, we'll make it deficit neutral by freezing Russian assets somehow, and then that will pay for it, or they have this zero interest loan plan, which is Trump's idea. So if you notice, you know, Trump never fought for us on the budget bill because he supported it, but he was emphatically against aid to Ukraine. Like, that was the one issue that we were told MAGA is, you know, their top issue. But then suddenly, we're now about 4 weeks into the media openly reporting on Johnson now, after having said no more aid, now he's warming to it. And Trump is awfully silent. Again, it's more than that because he... Like I told you, this is a vivid illustration of how when Johnson suddenly moves left on something, it is never, ever done without Trump's permission. Because again, Trump controls the party stronger than anyone since Abraham Lincoln. So again, I must ask, this was the issue du jour of the right. Okay, Tucker. Okay, this is Tucker's top issue. Tucker told us this is his top issue. I have a question for you. How come something that rhymes with Tucker hasn't, 4 weeks into this, hit this and said, wait a minute, why is Trump advising Johnson to give more aid to Ukraine? I don't understand that. I mean, not only did he toss our leverage on every last thing he's doing, but his entire effort now is built around a clever, creative way to get Ukraine aid to Biden's desk. And it's open source for weeks that Trump is giving Johnson a path to that. Has anyone picked up the phone to Trump and said, hey, did you have this conversation with Johnson? Is this Lend-Lease idea your plan? Why? What do we get for that? Why are we doing that? I mean, it's not like, there's one thing if Trump came out with a plan, look, I'll agree to a Lend-Lease plan if you write into statute state authority for deportations, which I would argue they need to be doing anyway without it, but certainly to get around the fear of the courts and whatever. All right, so now you're cooking with gas. As much as we hate the Ukraine grift, heck, we're in debt anyway. Give them more grift, whatever. It's a lost cause, but at least we get something for it. I can promise you that's not what's happening. It'll be some nebulous border provision. You see what I'm saying? Everything that is within our influence, we act like he doesn't exist. Democrats cannot get away, even though they have the Senate and they have the White House and, you know, they're very close to the majority in the House. But remember, when it comes to very unpopular issues, there is an ironclad rule. You need bipartisan buy-in to really ultimately get them across. And if conservatives use their influence over Republicans in the power they have, they could check most of what Biden is doing. And certainly, in this case, to not gratuitously pass a Ukraine bill. And of course, where do Republicans have the most influence? The conservative media, conservative organizations, and all these, Turning Point USA, where do they have the most influence? Over Lisa Murkowski, over Mitt Romney, over Mitch McConnell? No, over Donald Trump. Well, here's the good news. Donald Trump himself has the most influence over the entirety of the party. Right? We definitely see that when he speaks up and wants to kill a bill, like the Lankford bill, remember that? It really helped. That was a great illustration. But then why aren't we doing it now? Because for some reason, reasons that only Allah could understand, Trump is pushing Ukraine in. I can't figure it out. Like, I get it. We talked about it yesterday. He doesn't get Obamacare. And he's bad on the vaccines. But on Ukraine? I mean, I'm just speculating here. But this might be another example of, again, him trying to really kiss up to donors. I don't know. I'm just commenting on what I see. So anyway, just before we get to the states, let's not forget that Trump is everything at a federal level, even before being president, because he is the nominee, and he's much more than just a typical nominee. He is the king, the emperor of both the Republican Party and the conservative industry. So how come those communications aren't happening? And again, it's worse than just that the communication's not happening, that he is not speaking out for the good. He is downright actively supporting the bad. So it is what it is. So then we're left to move to the states. Now, right now, when you see all these illegals pouring over the border, the violent altercations, Texas DPS put out sent a memo to CBP this week outlining how they're getting more and more belligerent. Again, literally fits the definition of an invasion, which the states need to invoke, but they don't. By the way, I just want you to think about the imagery of October 7th in Israel. What's happening here with cases like Lake and Riley, let's go through some of these cases. It's no different than what Hamas did there. The Lake and Riley situation is exactly what happened with the murder and rape in Israel. It's more gradual. You see the belligerence at the border, and then you hear about all these cases on the interior. You know, there it was more dramatic because, you know, they invaded and then attacked the people within the mile radius of Gaza. This is the same thing. It's just more subtle. They fan out to every part of the country, and that's what the Lake and Riley situation is. There's just a lag time. But this is happening. I could spend all day on this, but I'll just give a couple cases. We have Brandon Ortiz Vite, a 25-year-old illegal alien from Pueblo, Mexico, was charged with carjacking and then shooting Ruby Garcia in Grand Rapids on Friday. We have a Venezuelan, Elvis Hernandez Pernalet, was arrested, charged with criminal sexual abuse by force, aggravated battery, by strangulation and robbery. He choked a woman into unconsciousness in Chicago. This was at the University of Illinois Chicago campus, and then sexually assaulted her. And then 3 hours later, he tried to do it to another woman, attempted to strangle her during a robbery. A week prior, the police arrested the guy for shoplifting allegations, but he was released an hour later. He was living in a Chicago migrant shelter run by the very NGOs that are given hundreds of millions in taxpayer funding directly from the U.S. and then also from the U.N., of which a third of that comes from the U.S. taxpayer anyway. So this is what we're living in. We catch these hyenas on lower crimes, let them go, and they continue to do their thing. Now, you might think, okay, this is Michigan, this is Chicago, but just remember, they're going everywhere. In Alabama, on Monday, 23-year-old Pablo Mendoza was arrested by Enterprise Police. This is a town, a small town in Coffee County, like the southeast part of the state. He was charged with rape in the first degree. What did he do? He raped a 14-year-old, physically helpless, mentally incapacitated girl. Now, again, I don't know if she was with him, part of an illegal alien community, or an American. I'm not. They never really say, obviously. They're not going to. It's a minor. It's a rape victim. But it occurred. The arrest was on Monday, but it occurred a month prior. The sheriff said he was here illegally. Now, I want you to understand, you look on a map there, and those of you from Alabama are obviously familiar. This is a rural area, tiny county, that Trump carried by a net of 53 points. And yet we have fiends pouring over the border that are evidently there. They're everywhere. It might still be subtle in some places, but it's going to reach critical mass and you're going to know it. See, one thing that you should be very afraid of is that the typical thought now is that you could flee the big cities, you know, all this stuff that's going on and we're talking about in Chicago, New York, and live in a rural area. And that is true as it relates to domestic crime. You're generally going to be free from that. That's generally endemic of the cities. But when it comes to the illegal invaders, we've talked about this for many years. A lot of them do get jobs in agriculture, things like that, and they settle in rural areas. I mean, the majority are still in big, you know, in sheer numbers are going to be in places like New York and Chicago. But it doesn't take many in a county of 50,000 people to completely destroy its safety and culture. Just understand that that is happening, and that is the imperative of states and counties to rid themselves of this. I want to play a minute clip for you from Fox 17 in Franklin, Tennessee, from Nashville, about DHS sending a notice that 600 citizens were looking to travel to Central Tennessee. Take a listen here.
The city of Franklin received this letter from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. In short, it says that hundreds of people going through the immigration process could end up in Middle Tennessee cities. Last fall, DHS sent this official notice saying nearly 600, quote, non-citizens were looking to travel to these areas highlighted on your screen. Most of them coming from Guatemala, Venezuela, Honduras, and Mexico.
It's very troubling that, you know, someone can come into this country, name Nashville or greater Nashville as a destination, and we're not finding out about it for months later.
U.S. Congressman Andy Ogles telling Fox 17 News that he had a conference call with DHS yesterday with a series of questions, including a request for updated numbers, how people will be tracked, and if they have prior convictions.
They didn't have any good answers.
The notice says DHS may release non-citizens from custody who have been fully screened and vetted pending the outcome of their immigration process. They'll also have check-ins with ICE.
going through the process correctly would mean applying for some sort of visa. And so coming across the border and wanting to be processed and claiming asylum is we've clearly.
So basically, they could come in now and they could tell CBP, I want this red county. I want Central Tennessee. They just pick a destination and the feds give them papers and they walk right in. 600. And that, again, that was just one tranche from a couple months ago. You know, there's a congressman, Andy Ogles, was questioning DHS on this. He found out about this several months later, that there was such a notice that was sent months later to local officials. Oh, yeah, you're going to have hundreds of people coming with papers. And this leads me to the main point I want to make, the doctrine of lesser magistrates. There's something very effective about preemptively saying no to something. See, like I say, the more something is implemented, the more it gets legitimacy, even if it's totally illegitimate. Wow, this is the way it is. Biden gave them papers. You can't do anything. But if you preempt something, you act first. It would be very powerful. There's a major action item we need. We have de facto amnesty, but Biden, it's open source being reported. Biden is contemplating amnesty du jour. And if you think about it from his perspective, why not? So far, Republicans had demonstrated, like I say before, Biden could go and arrest political opponents. He could bring in a Hamas rape squad, and Republicans will say we can't have a government shutdown. They gave him everything he wanted, plus they sold out their leverage. And generally speaking, the red states have not yet demonstrated that they're going to check him. So why wouldn't he? Everything he's doing is illegal. Why not just go for the glory? Why not just issue them green cards? Straight up. They're claiming they're going to start with people who, you know, claim to have been here for at least 10 years. What if the red states got into session and, among other things, called that shot immediately before he does it, while he's contemplating? See, this was always what was weak about Trump. Trump would openly threaten and contemplate something, then the left would mobilize, and they were very successful. What you really need to do is just do it. So, And the left usually is good at that, but now they're kind of contemplating this. Now is the time to get into session and say that the red states will not recognize that status. You know, it's one thing you say, well, you know, you have illegal immigration enforcement, but you can't get involved in the legal paperwork. That's totally by the feds. Yeah, but not if you just take illegals and illegally give them green cards. That we will not recognize them. And then that parlays into all the other laws we need to pass, which is everything leading up to, as close to, and eventually including deporting, but certainly dissuading, cutting off all benefits, including education, healthcare, anything, and severe, leveraging severe prison sentencing for those caught illegally and making illegal presence a crime, to at least self-deport and at least just stay in the blue states. I'm telling you, this needs to be done. We will not have a country, and in this respect, even red states, there's too many of them. And again, they need to emphatically make the case that this is an invasion. They need to stare down the courts and they say, you cannot get involved. And like I told you a couple days ago, that does have its effect on Republicans. Just to reiterate, again, Compact Clause of Article 1, Section 10 says a state cannot make war, raise an army to conduct war, unless it's invaded. So meaning, we're not even talking about them conducting war. Meaning, under the Constitution, the red states, certainly Texas, but really all of them, could join, get together, send their guardsmen there, and start shooting at people coming over. That is absolutely straight out, unambiguously in the Constitution. You all saw those videos of the belligerents. They could absolutely do that. But we're not even talking about that. We're just talking about getting them out. See what I'm saying? When we're talking about invoking the invasion clause to make an end run around the erroneous judicial edict of federal preemption on immigration law, I'll do you one better. They could conduct war. So certainly they could do this by a mile. But for those of you who still don't think it meets the literal classic definition of invasion, let me just tell you, the founders were very clear about what they meant. It wasn't just a formal like Mexican army or Canadian army or French Canadians coming in the French Indian War style, you know, coming in with an army, an official war. They meant imminent danger, which is what we're in by a mile. John Marshall, everyone knows, the original judicial supremacist, one of the most famous founders from Virginia, framers of the Constitution, one of the biggest Federalists. When he's commenting at the ratification convention, the Virginia ratification convention, on the implied power of the compact clause, meaning a state cannot raise an army, that's the federal government, and conduct war, except for under invasion, that this power is when they find it necessary. They find it necessary. It's not subject to the federal courts. If they believe they are in danger, meaning if they left it, and this is a point that I forget, I think it was in the Bowie case, the Texas barriers in the river. It was a partial dissent by Fifth Circuit Judge Jim Ho made this case that if it's subject to the federal court saying, oh, we believe this is valid, then it neutered the whole clause. The whole point was that states were scared that they would be at the whims of the federal government. Remember back then, even without a capricious federal government like you have today, you still had the point that with communication and transportation back then, you know, we have a bunch of, let's say, Indian tribes go and act violent and attack us. I can't wait until you get into session in Congress and, you know, send the army over. We got to deal with it. That's what it was. Marshall wrote, the state legislatures had power to command and govern their militia before the Constitution and have it still undeniably. To me, it appears unquestionable that the state governments can call forth the militia in case the Constitution should be adopted in the same manner as they could have done before its adoption. In other words, you're not losing this power. And so he's talking about specifically this clause under Article 1, Section 10. What excludes every possibility of doubt is the last part of it, meaning a last part of the compact clause, quote, unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. Okay? Imminent danger that they can't delay. We've been in 3 years, and of course there's delay, because in this case it's even worse. It's not like, oh, they'll get back into session. The federal government is orchestrating the invasion, literally. Well, Daniel, you're stuck. The feds have... No, they don't. If the state feels it's an imminent danger, it could repel. Again, I mean, this is... They could have heavy weaponry and planes, and they could bomb the cartels if they wanted to. Under this power, it is undeniable. Marshall used very strong language. Justice Joseph Story, a generation later, the most respected commentary on the Constitution. A state may be so situated that it may become indispensable to possess military forces to resist an expected invasion or insurrection. The danger may be too imminent for delay. Under such circumstances, a state will have a right to raise troops for its own safety, even without the consent of Congress. Again, imminent danger. It was very clear. It wasn't like a formal war. The problem is the governors haven't even cited this and emphatically. And you a lot of this, remember, is a PR war. And if they would do what I'm doing on this show, use their platforms, have special sessions, do it in unison. The formula for doctrine of lesser magistrates under Federalist 46, that you start with the big states and then the small states, they all get together simultaneously, all the respective branches of numerous states, with the support of the people, popular sentiment, done. This is so achievable. Oh, I just wanted a talking point for the election. No, I actually believe it's a problem and it needs to be solved. And then the Biden administration would be stuck. And especially if they preemptively call his shot on the green cards and say they won't recognize them. By the way, there is a bill to watch out for, Idaho House Bill 753. It's similar to Texas SB 4. But as I've said before, we need this on the interior, not just as a tool if you're come in over the border, but if we just catch you in Idaho, makes it a crime, it enhances the crimes for reentry, leverages against leverages self-deportation against criminal penalties. So again, we don't have a bill yet to actually deport, but it leverages severe penalties, so it gives you off if you're willing to leave. It did pass out of the House State Affairs Committee. I was surprised. So that's something we really need to push in Idaho and every other state. By the way, I just saw recently the Florida grand jury estimates that Florida spends $1.3 billion a year on hospital care for illegals. One of the bills signed by DeSantis last year made it mandatory for the relevant department to report on the cost. So they have statistics on that. And the Florida grand jury used it to extrapolate the true cost would probably be $1.3 billion a year. And a lot of that is spent on maternity care, which basically brings forth anchor babies to hang ourselves. So folks, I guarantee you if we don't stop this, this is coming to a red state near you. It's already there. It's not that it's coming. It has come, and we need to fight it. And remember, too often we're just content with, oh well, it's a nice red state. You know, it's great. We don't have to worry about anything. Ha ha ha, look at what the Dems are doing to blue state. Blue states are our early warning system that you immediately have to buckle down in your supposed red states. You don't do that, you're screwed. So that's immigration. Obviously, there's crime. Crime is the easiest thing to do at the lesser magistrate because that actually is within the province of local power. Very few states have tightened their criminal statutes and their parole. You know, perfect example of this in a blue state early warning system. Some of you might have seen this article, the embodiment of criminal justice reform. Illinois parole board member resigns after convict stabbed his ex-girlfriend's 11-year-old son to death as he tried to protect her a day after being freed from jail. So you had one of these namby-pamby leftists appointed to the parole board by Governor Pritzker let out a guy who killed someone the very day he was let out. Leanne Miller was the name of the member. She resigned. And again, you might think this is a blue state problem, but I'm just telling you, it's more evidently absurd in blue states, but it's really happening everywhere. You know, obviously, a lot of you are seeing what's going on in New York City, where there's now a trend. I mean, can you imagine just two generations ago, our grandparents, picturing just mobs walking down a street, just randomly beating people? We never had that in civil society. Now we have that. But now it's ratcheted up a notch that they're specifically targeting women. So now there's a whole rash of black males, and it's exclusively black males, attacking white females on the streets of Manhattan or other parts of the city. 33-year-old Franz Judy had 7 priors when he was out with little deterrent, randomly punched a woman, broke her face and jaw, and he was apprehended, but he was released yet again. 7 priors, rearranges a woman's face out of nowhere. You know why? Because he was only charged with misdemeanor assault. I've said this a lot of times, that, you know, this whole over-incarceration canard, it's such bull, because even at the charging level, we often never charge a guy with the severity of what he did, and then it just goes down, you know, from there on the indictment level, on the, you know, plea bargains, ultimately on the conviction level, and then the sentencing level. It goes down, 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 down. So, you know, this is something, again, it's more egregious in New York, but it's something we haven't solved in red states. You'll often see these cases where a guy just like, again, it's not like, you know, you had kind of a mutual fight or something, or just a totally innocent person, guy comes up to and just, you know, it's something, it's just really, really life-altering experience. And you'll find, I mean, this is unique, it's not even a felony at all, but sometimes it will be second degree, third degree. Like, wait, what do you mean? Just literally break someone's face out of nowhere. And again, a lot of this has to do with premeditation. Too often the severity of degrees, which then triggers the proper sentencing, is based off of premeditation. But a lot of times it's the vagrants. It's not like the CSI, you know, plot, you know, that's individualized. Those people usually are targeting people they know. The people that are ubiquitous threats to anyone on the street are often these vagrants that just randomly go up to someone. And a lot of them are charged with things that would shock you, that from the get-go barely trigger prison time before you even start whittling it down. Again, there's a lot more we can do in red states, tightening up aggravated assault. I think two things. I mean, number one, we've seen a lot of these videos of black hordes just surrounding someone for being white and just beating them. There's got to be an enhancement charge for group violence. And then also for these just unprovoked, senseless beating when it results in bodily harm. It's got to be much, much higher. Some states have better laws, but these are the sort of ideas that we need to start thinking of. Because remember, this is a problem in a lot of cities in red states. The problem is the blue states are so absurd that, yeah, it's always going to be one or two levels worse there at that time. But it's our early warning system. What you have today in blue cities, you'll have tomorrow in red cities. What you had yesterday in blue cities, you already have. Obviously, we have the case of the NYPD officer, Jonathan Diller, who was shot during a traffic stop in Queens. The suspect had 21 prior arrests. Crime is simple. At a, you know, lower level, we should be doing immigration. Then there's also green energy is the third one I wanted to talk about. You know, I've said this over and over again. If red states would treat the Green New Deal the way they originally, at least, treated, not now, Medicaid expansion, it would totally upend it. Red states have more land. It takes land to do carbon capture, to do wind and solar, and things like that. But instead, states like South Carolina and Georgia, the governors just grovel. Oh my gosh, the job creation, they create tax incentives to bring in the EVs. There's Georgia HB 206. It's essentially a Green New Deal for the state. Meaning, not only is it not blocking the federal stuff, it adds new incentives. Majority of Republicans voted for it. in the Georgia House. Conversely, doesn't have to, well, here, let me give you another example. This is from Wyoming, the Cowboy Daily News. A research lab located on the doorstep of the Dry Fork Station power plant, about 10 miles north of Gillette, has become the catalyst for boosting coal-burning fuel in the future. Well, you might think, well, that sounds good. Catalyst for burning coal. Well, no. A strategic partnership between an energy research organization associated with the University of Wyoming and California filtration business received $4.6 million Thursday from the U.S. Department of Energy to continue cutting-edge work on capturing and storing carbon dioxide. So in other words, what they're doing now is they're establishing a precedent and a premise that the only way you could have coal or other natural fuels is if you do carbon capture. And the red states are just gobbling up that money. Conversely, this is in Florida. This is from grist.org. I don't know what this is. In Florida, the effects of climate change are, well, I'm not going to read their drivel here. It's a left-wing site, but the point is they complain that DeSantis is about to sign a bill that would ban offshore wind energy, relax regulation of natural gas pipelines, and delete the majority of mentions of climate change from existing state laws. See, the same way we shouldn't have grooming, we shouldn't have transgender stuff ever appearing anywhere in state government or state-controlled schools, state-controlled institutions, the same needs to apply to global warming. And what this bill does, sponsored by Representative Bobby Payne, would strike 8 references to climate change in current state laws, according to the Tampa Bay Times. It would eliminate a green government grant program that helps cities and school districts cut their carbon emissions. A 2008 policy stating that Florida is at the front lines of climate change that must have been under Charlie Crist and can reduce those impacts by cutting emissions would be replaced by a new goal, providing an adequate, reliable, and cost-effective supply of energy for the state in a manner that promotes the health and welfare of the public and economic growth. That's what we need. So, there you go. That's what leadership looks like. In addition to Tampa Bay Times reports, Governor DeSantis' office quietly helped write a bill to curtail wind energy. Email records provided to the Tampa Bay Times show. A version of that bill is now awaiting DeSantis' signature, which will ban offshore wind turbines in state waters. It also proposes to delete the majority of references to climate change. This is Senate Bill 1624, House Bill 1645. Even though the state has no operational wind farms, because Florida generally has slower wind speeds, still the ban on offshore turbines in state waters puzzled and frustrated opponents who pointed to the fact that wind energy technology is rapidly improving. The bill's sponsor, including Senator Jay Collins, said if that happens, they'd repeal the ban, meaning if the technology gets better. While debate over the bill continued in the halls of the legislature, DeSantis' office weighed in via email. Cody Farrell, deputy chief of staff, sent wording related to the wind ban multiple times to Collins and his staff. And they think it's sinister, but this is what leadership looks like. This, my friends, is what leadership looks like. It doesn't have to be this way. Everything you don't like, inflation, we could do currency bills. Talked about that. Green energy, we could ban green energy in red states. Crime is easy. Illegal immigration, ban it. And we've discussed the messaging and policies behind that to push back against the courts. The indoctrination is obvious. That should be a no-brainer. Shouldn't be going on in any of these states. But we still have it going on. And then also, we have, I forget the bill number, I don't have it in front of me, but Steve Friend's bill in Tennessee to either prohibit local law enforcement from joining JTTFs. That's a joint terrorism task force where the FBI just grabs law enforcement unaccountable to the elected sheriff. They don't even know what's going on because a lot of times they're sworn off by security clearances. They can't talk about what they're working on, even with their superiors, like the elected sheriff, to either give the elected sheriff oversight, veto power over it. These are just some ideas that need to be done. Also, you know, Nathan Dom's bills. Senator Nathan Dom from Oklahoma, he's got Senate Bill 1199, allows sheriffs to arrest federal officers who attempt to confiscate guns. Senate Bill 1200 requires federal agents and officers to receive permission from the county sheriff before operating in their county. Senate Bill 1201 expands the sheriff's ability to form a posse to include prohibiting agents, employees, and officers of the federal government from violating the constitutional rights of the people. By the way, he also has the bill we talked about on birthright citizenship, 1226, from the year 2022. It's not this year. Basically, it would require the hospitals to, only give out birth certificates to those that could attest to the citizenship, not being here illegally, and the state would not grant documents to those who are not proven to be here illegally. This is, folks, this is the only solution. I'm telling you, it could be done. Everything except for foreign policy could be done. And the more they would do it, the more it would put the left between a rock and a hard place. Because the more you accomplish, the more it becomes popular. And the more electorally they would be on the hook. I'm telling you. Except you leverage it in areas where you already win big. But in order to do that, we need a movement that's focused on the legislation, focused on the good guys, focused on taking out the bad guys, focused on the primaries again. Until I'm blue in the face. Most state legislative primaries have yet to occur this year. June, July, August are going to be the busiest months. Couple in May, but not much. We have time. We could mobilize. All these policies, I'm telling you, hinge upon the success that we have to building a Freedom Caucus. The states that were totally done, like, I haven't talked much about Kentucky, okay? Kentucky, we failed to get an anti-DEI bill. DEI is kind of consensus, but we couldn't even get that past Kentucky legislature. By the way, Kentucky is a really good state, theoretically, because it's a rare state where you have a Democrat governor, but Republicans have 3-1 majorities, and not only that, you only need a simple majority to override the governor. The legislature is very powerful there. You could essentially govern, not just block the bad things of the governor, but pass good things he vetoes, and you don't even have to have all the Republicans because you only need a simple majority, but they have very strong majorities, like 80-20 in the House. So you could even afford to lose a number of rhinos. But unfortunately, they're all rhinos, except for a few. So states like Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, we get nothing because we just have horrible Alabama. But South Carolina, Wyoming, Idaho, we have Freedom Caucuses. We're starting to put points on the board. It's commensurate with how much we fight. And, you know, the stronger the movement we have behind an issue, the more we force them on Chloe's Law, the tranny stuff, the DEI. It looks like in South Carolina, we're going to ban DEI. By the way, Adam Morgan also introduced the Florida bill on squatters, the bill that DeSantis just signed, getting rid of squatters. It's slowly catching fire. Frustratingly enough that you see what could happen if we actually had a movement, but we don't, so it's very slow. But it doesn't have to be this way. But getting back to what I started out with, my anecdote that I had, and I'm sure a lot of you, when you talk to kind of normie conservative voters, what do I mean by a normie conservative voter? They don't listen to this program. They don't know what you know, but they roughly share our values, and they're very upset with what's going on. If they only focused on this and they only understood, if you live in a red state, getting active on these issues and primaries is 100 times more important than the presidential election. Because aside from all the other reasons, at the end of the day, I can't be more pro-Trump than Trump is himself. He wants to put his daughter-in-law, some boob, in charge of the RNC, who's putting out music video albums of horrible vocals. I can't help that. You know what I mean? He's not just grifting the GOP, grifting the conservative movement, making bad endorsements, endorsing bad policies, Ukraine, the vaccines, Bud Light, Bruce Jenner. But he's grifting his own victory. That's the bottom line. I'm saying, run a competent campaign. So that is where all Republican voters are putting their energy. Not even much energy, just go out and vote. It's stupid. It doesn't have to be this way. We could change the country tomorrow with the doctrine of lesser magistrates. Folks, that closes another very productive week. I need you to make sure we get the normies and reach these normies. And that's why we got to, you know, get up there on the iTunes charts. Please give us a 5-star rating with a comment. That will help. Send this show to every one of your friends and relatives. Hope you guys, for our Christian audience, has a blessed Easter and a terrific weekend. We'll be back same time, same place Monday. God bless y'all. Hosea 4:6.